say you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with S.K. Sakakibara, a former deputy finance minister of Japan. He has been a professor at Aoyama University, emphasizing international relations and international finance. I've known him for many years. When I used to work in the private sector with Soros Fund Management, we had interesting discussions about the strengthening of the yen and how Japanese foreign entities might help alleviate the strengthening of the yen by continuing to hold dollars rather than converting things and repatriating home. We've been involved in many discussions, and I will tell you he is a deep diver, meaning he has taught me a great deal about scuba diving through our conversations over the years. Most recently, Sakakibara-san has been a commissioner on the Spence Stiglitz-led Commission on Global Economic Transformation that is sponsored by INET. Sakakibara-san, welcome and thank you for joining me tonight.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
So we have now a very, very profound set of challenges, changes in the world with the onset of the pandemic. You have always been a very, very independent thinker. And so I'm fascinated because I think many things are being challenged, many things are being unmasked. But why don't we start with the discussion of how Japan is handling the pandemic and what kind of change in the mindset you're experiencing in Japan as a result of these of this crisis?
Well, compared to other countries, Japan has dealt with the pandemic fairly well. This is partly because of the Japanese way of behaving, because Japanese do not shake hands, they do not hug, they bow, and they, you know, take their shoes when they go into the house. So that those, you know, Japanese traditional sort of behavior has helped to calm down the pandemic compared to other countries.
And have you experienced a disruption, meaning a lockdown, people staying at home rather than going to work and things like we have going on in the United States currently?
Not that much, you know. The people has been behaving pretty much what they have been doing in recent months. So that I do not see any major change in the behavior of the people in recent months.
I see.
So, you know, in summary, you know, this pandemic has not really affected the Japanese people that much compared to other countries.
In the run-up here to the U.S. presidential election, the tensions between candidate Biden and President Trump over the handling of the pandemic and the very large number of cases and deaths. You know, the United States is less than 5% of the world's population, and it's almost 25% of the deaths and more than 25% of the cases that have been reared. So people are very critical, and it is a great source of political controversy. But as you said, you have certain customs in Japan, and in America, we have this tremendous regard for individual freedom, even if it involves the freedom for you to infect me with a disease that you carry, which I don't think is a particularly healthy approach. But we are quite burdened by this. In looking at the world now. Mm-hmm. We see very low interest rates, all the central banks, and very, what you might call, rising debt to GDP ratios. And some have said that the world must look into the crystal ball through the perspective of Japan, which has been in this place for much longer. And also some of these countries are seeing an aging population demographic and other things, so that Japan might be what you might call a foreshadowing. The adjustments that you've been through may be a foreshadowing for where the rest, many other places in the world outside of Africa, are headed. Do you see the Japanese experience as informative for the adjustment patterns that others will go through, say in Europe and the United States and elsewhere?
Yeah, I think so. Particularly for, you know, in terms of the aging, Japan is, you know, ahead of other countries. So that what we have experienced will eventually be sort of experienced by other countries. So that, you know, we may be at least in some sense an indicator for other countries.
Mm-hmm. And do you think, how would I say, at this juncture, is Japan in a good place looking toward the future?
Yeah, I think, you know, Japanese situation right now is not necessarily bad. You know, we have been experiencing on the average 1% growth rate, but with the maturity of the economy, 1% growth rate would be quite sufficient. And I think, you know, in general, the Japanese people are quite satisfied with what's going on at this moment.
Now, I think that Japan as a place, as an individual economy, seems to be in good shape, but we read continuously now about a great deal of turbulence in Asia, whether it's Modi's India or China, U.S.-Chinese relations. There seems to be a very unsettled geopolitical environment. How from the perspective of a leader in Japan, do you see those challenges opening up at this time?
Of course, the U.S.-China confrontation has affected Japan quite significantly, but Japan is in a very delicate position. In terms of national security, Japan is the U.S. ally. But in terms of the economic relationship, you know, Japan-China economic relationship is much stronger than Japan-U.S. Economic relationship. So in a sense, Japan is in between Japan and China. And so far, I think we have been, you know, fulfilling that role quite well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And is that because of the large foreign direct investment for production in China? Or are there many, many aspects to the intertwined nature of the Japanese and Chinese economy?
Well, foreign investment in China is one factor. But, you know, if you sort of follow the history of the Japan, Japan has been sort of, you know, influenced by Chinese civilization quite significantly. And that mm-hmm. still is the case, you know. Japanese character is Chinese character, right? So that, you know, Japanese-Chinese relationship has been very old, and that is still continuing.
And how does the tension between U.S. and China affect how Japan responds or acts? And what are some of the challenges that this presents?
We don't want this, you know, confrontation to become persistent and become stronger, because we have good relationship with both countries. So that confrontation between China and in the U.S. does affect Japan in a sense that we are being split, you know, between the two countries.
And do you see
yes,
a split between the two countries getting worse at this point? Or do you think the tension that we're at now is near the high point?
I think it is near the high point. I think both China and US is quite mature, so that I think at least the leaders of the two countries see that further deterioration of the relationship would not benefit neither China or the United States. So I am somewhat optimistic about the relationship.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it must be very interesting in the sense that, as you mentioned, the kind of what you might call the Asian philosophy mm-hmm. and perspective of the mindset is somewhat different than what I'll call Cartesian Enlightenment thinking that comes from the West. Mm-hmm. And yet the Japanese have been so successful in mm-hmm. their interaction with the West.
Right.
Going back to the years when you and I met, probably in the late 1980s, mm-hmm. and even before that, Japan has, which you might call, navigated through, the Western customs and practices, and yet now the world is perhaps migrating back towards a more Eastern philosophy, and the kind of simple mechanical free market approach espoused by the United States and the UK and others, it doesn't seem like it's rising. It seems like it's under question, and a bigger role for the state, a relationship between state-owned enterprise and private sector and other things is more prevalent in Asia. And I sense people, particularly in emerging countries, are migrating toward that mixed model relative to the American model.
I agree with you. You know, the American model is the market capitalism. You more or less leave many things to the market to determine. But Chinese model would be what I could call, state capitalism. So that state intervenes in the market, but in the end, market dominates the result of the things. So that this mixture of market and state, a la China, seems to be quite strong these days. And as you say, people may be migrating to pure sort of market capitalism to Chinese type state capitalism.
I remember years ago, you gave me a book that you wrote.
Oh, is that right?
it was a book on maybe I would call different kinds of capitalism.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Japanese capitalism? Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. And I remember that book being, I think it was called Beyond Capitalism.
That's right. I remember that.
And I learned a great deal from studying Japan all in all, but in particular from you as a teacher and guide to understanding the practices and the institutions. At the current juncture, what do you see as the role of India? I keep reading how with the One Belt, One Road policy and with the movement into Africa, that India feels quite isolated as China is reaching outward in making more and deeper global relationships. What do you see taking place in India and how it's responding to the challenges of the day?
Yeah, first of all, Japanese-Indian relationship has been quite favorable for years. Japanese-Chinese relationship has had some ups and downs. But mm-hmm. Japanese-Indian relationship somewhat different. It has always been, very favorite, and Japan helped India to gain independence. So that Japan-India is very close, and that is very important for Japan, because China is to some extent a threat to Japan, so that alliance with India is very important for Japan.
In what areas are you intertwined with or involved with India? What is the sectors or the nature of the commerce?
Yeah, that one is prominent sector is IT sector. You know, IT. You know, companies like Wipro, Infosys, and Tata Consulting. They are all in Japan, you know, doing significant, significant work in this country.
I see.
I personally was involved with Wipro, in India, and I have been helping Wipro to do their operations in Japan.
Oh, that's interesting. Premji University has an affiliation with INET.
Is it right? I know Mr. Premji very well.
We have done a joint venture with them in Bangalore, and we have some people who are joint faculty, and some of the Nobel laureates like Joe Stiglitz and James Heckman, who we work with, have been doing lots of research on early childhood developments or various different challenges that relate to Indian development and the role of the state. I think it's slowed down a little bit since Modi had come into power. It was much more vibrant previously, but it seems to be reviving right now. And Gaurav Dalmia, who's one of our board members, is really working with me to try to reinvigorate. I think India is a very important place, particularly with regard to climate change and energy transformation, not just for India, but for the whole world.
Yeah, Mr. Premji is a key person. You know, he has good contact with the Indian government and, has wide relationship with the rest of the world.
That's for sure. I guess one of the things that you hear in the multilateral institutions in Washington and Geneva and Brussels and elsewhere is concern that the U.S.-China relationship now will break down over these tensions, and that the ability to collaborate on climate transformation will be quite badly harmed. And obviously, India, China, and the United States play a very big role in the carbon emissions that planet Earth will experience over the next 10 to 15 years. And whether we can cooperate, I think, is an open question, but a very important one.
Yeah, I am worried about U.S.-China relationship. As you said, the relationship may deteriorate. But precisely because of that, India is very important. Cooperation with India, is very important. India is another big Asian countries, which does have a lot of influence.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, they're almost 1.4 billion people at this juncture.
That's right. That's right.
And with that many people and an energy system that, along with economic development, needs to be transformed to be less carbon intensive.
Oh, that's right.
It matters not only the nature of how energy is produced, but the sheer scale for the challenges of planet Earth. And I would hope that the world would understand. Now, I'm often concerned, particularly in Africa and South Asia, that they are asked to change their energy system at the time when there are so many very important needs related to health and survival in these poorer countries. And to ask them to transform their energy system and neglect some of these other things, while the wealthier countries are consuming much more energy, like BTUs per capita, is almost criminal. And it's my hope that we can create the awareness that transforming the Indian energy base positively affects the West and Japan.
Yeah, I think so.
And so we all should contribute to making that transformation, because we're all going to benefit. And I think that India, because of its place in the stage of development, does need that help, does need those financial and technological assistances to accomplish the goals that are necessary for the well-being of planet Earth.
Yeah, one key sort of energy is atomic power energy, which could be quite harmful, but, you know, Japan is now trying to export atomic energy sort of generation to other countries in Asia. And I think that would be helpful.
Back to the Japanese economy, what are the sectors in Japan that are rising? The places in the West, they would say, are your comparative advantage. What's thriving in the Japanese economy at this point, and what is new and being invested in and built up?
Well, it used to be the manufacturing sector, but manufacturing sector has been sort of, you know, followed by China and India and others, so that Japan is slowly moving toward the service sector. And that has become the key sort of promoter of the Japanese economy. You know, manufacturing sector is still there, but it's not what it used to be.
I remember it was almost ominous in the early to mid 80s that people in Washington thought that Japan was going to take over the world. and the manufacturing sector, particularly, I'm from Detroit, Michigan, the auto industry.
Oh, I see.
Was quite powerful in as Toyota and others, Nissan and others grew, and displacing an American auto industry that was struggling to modernize and evolve.
Oh, that's right. Toyota is still quite strong.
Yes, it is. And I drive a Toyota Prius, so I speak as a Detroiter who, how would I say, may not be considered patriotic to my home city. But
good friend of mine. I stayed as a high school student in New York as an exchange student, and my host family, he drives Toyota and Honda.
And so at this juncture, all around the world, the concerns of automation, machine learning, and the replacement of labor by artificial intelligence and automation has become a big concern. How is that unfolding in Japan at this point?
I think, you know, Japanese is quite advanced in robotics. So that, you know, robotics sort of population is really, you know, widespread in this country. And, you know, AI is also another factor which is driving the Japanese economy. So Japanese economy, I think, is changing, you know, from the manufacture industry-based toward, you know, more sub-industry sort of oriented.
And as your population is aging, is the healthcare sector becoming a larger proportion of the gross national product?
Yeah, not that conspicuously, but gradually that will take place. But one thing, you know, Japanese, you know, population is aging, but the Japanese old people are quite healthy, like myself.
Are you still scuba diving?
Yeah. Every summer I do that.
That's great.
Scuba diving at 80 is not really that bad, you know?
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Let me ask, why do you think the Japanese people, in comparison with other cultures, are so healthy? What are the secrets to this vitality and longevity?
Yeah, one is the cuisine. Japanese food is quite healthy. You know, and the fish and, you know, vegetables and so on. So that one factor is what we eat. But another is health sort of insurance scheme that covers entire nation. So that we could go to the hospital anytime with relatively low cost. And that is very helpful.
Yes. And from what I understand, in studying comparative healthcare systems, the place we're going to, the hospital, is less expensive. Mm-hmm. Means that people go in early for preventive care.
That's right, that's right.
And don't wait until they're extremely sick and damaged and have long-term consequences.
As a matter of fact, this sort of practice has been quite widespread. We call that human being docs. We go into the docs, you know, that is hospital, mm-hmm. to check, mm-hmm. you know, various parts of our body. And that has become quite popular. And ordinary people goes into hospital at least once a year to check, you know, various parts of their body. You know, mm-hmm. What is called the, you know, human being docs.
Good. And I would think you would therefore detect things sooner.
That's right. That's right.
And that would, how would I say, perhaps limit the cost as well as the severity.
That's right.
Of
that's
things
right.
that you can exactly impair right. your health in the long term.
And lots of people do that, and major companies, provide that kind of service to all their employees.
Mm-hmm. 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 Well, that's a very interesting. I would imagine in places like the United States, they are going to be looking for a better health model in light of the pandemic and its and the consequences of what's been revealed and how the incidence of illness really relates to what I will call the class structure of the society, and that instead of healthcare being a human right, it's viewed as a product that the wealthy can have good quality, but the less wealthy are not, do not have it as available to them.
In that sense, you could say that the Japanese society is quite egalitarian. 99% of the people are middle class, and we don't have extremely poor people or extremely rich people that much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I gathered places like Norway and Japan are thriving and both exhibit those kind of characteristics relative to, say, the Anglo-Saxon countries.
Well, that's right. That's true.
How is China in that regard? Are they maintaining a broad-based system for healthcare and other things and education and other things for the population? Or is it more hierarchical, like, say, the United States?
I think it is quite hierarchical. And, China is a big country with a huge population. So that, income equality there is quite big. So that's one thing that the China has to overcome, you know, this income disparity. Although it's a socialist country, it's class does exist in that country.
Mm-hmm. I once saw a consulting report uh-huh. comparing the governance of America with China.
Uh-huh.
And it said in the report, if you took everybody in the House of Representatives, uh-huh. the Senate, everybody under secretary or higher in the executive branch, uh-huh. and the Supreme Court justices, you put them all together, and with a $15 trillion economy, uh-huh. that group of people was worth $6.6
billion. 6.6, I see.
And it was about 800 people uh-huh. in all. In China, it was a $9 trillion economy,
uh-huh.
and the 72 people in the National People's Congress uh-huh. were worth almost $70 billion,
which is
more than 10 times what all of the American administration put together was worth.
I see.
And so that the so-called princelings uh-huh. had an enormous concentration of wealth and also dominated governance. And this was right on the cusp of what they began at the time and is now continued as the anti-corruption campaign.
Uh-huh.
Because they felt that things in the Communist Party were getting to the place where they found it very difficult to represent a broader base of the population, given the concentration of wealth and the wealth of the members of the National People's Congress.
That's right.
But So I think, I guess that's a long-winded way for me to say that your perception of what was happening in China is consistent with this report that I read about the nature of power and inequality within that country.
Yeah, China, although it claims to be a socialist country, it's a very class type, you know, society. You know, Japan is more socialistic than China.
So in the unfolding of China and India, what are the tensions that exist between those two countries? What are they struggling over? I keep reading about border disputes and other things.
Yeah, yeah.
What's at the core of that?
Well, there has been border dispute, but the border dispute has been always there. So that I am not that much worried about, you know, international tensions between the two countries.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a squabble, but it's not something that can be ignited into a larger...
I don't see any larger sort of warfare between the two countries.
Yeah, yeah. How about the naval concerns with the United States Navy, the growing Chinese Navy, and various different flashpoints in the Pacific? Is that a bigger source of concern?
I think so. China is now developing its Navy, and, there would be some kind of sort of friction between U.S., 7th Fleet and Chinese growing Navy in Asian sort of ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, again, I don't see any major sort of war or collision between the two countries.
Yeah, I used to work in the United States Congress, and people tell me that we see news stories every year as the Defense Appropriations Bill is about to pass about the coming challenge of China, mm-hmm. so that everybody is inspired to agree to give the Defense Department the money they want.
I see,
but it comes and goes according to the budget marketing, and I don't know what the true intelligence is mm-hmm. in that realm, but it's. We do in the nationalistic fervor that's taken over in the United States, we do hear more and more about a Chinese naval threat from key scholars and members of the media.
Yeah, that kind of sort of affliction tends to be overemphasized for various sort of reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. I agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
So how about, is Japan very, what might call observing or developing strategies in relation to the development of Africa?
Well, Japanese involvement in Africa has not been that deep, but although they're trying, we should cooperate with India in sort of cooperating with those African countries where Indian influence is quite big.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think a country like Japan, with your sophisticated infrastructure and systems, mm-hmm. and the growing importance of technology, may play a role. I've just been talking with the group that is part of the Alibaba group of Jack Ma, mm-hmm. called the Luhan Academy, and Long Chen, who is the director of the Luhan Academy, and I had a talk the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a great deal of hope that technological platforms and mobile payment systems mm-hmm. can make up for some of the lack of institutions like banking and financial networks and other things and create a more integrated market.
Right.
And they were talking about how, let us say, a woman is a fashion designer
mm-hmm.
and she's not working for a major corporation.
Mm-hmm.
In this world, if she has a design that people find inspiring,
mm-hmm.
the ability to see it on the internet and the ability to sell it
mm-hmm.
in many, many different places across the continent
mm-hmm.
is possible
I
with
see.
This internet infrastructure, which otherwise would just be a local market, not a continental market.
Mm-hmm.
So that the economies of scale and the bringing alive entrepreneurs who otherwise would not invest themselves fully because of the, the new potential of profitability and vitality may be a new form of development that we haven't seen in what I might call the East Asian models and others that depended more on manufacturing.
I think because of the internet and the other sort of new schemes, that the world has become much more global than before.
Yeah, I think that's right. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's global with regard to the transfer of goods, the transfer of technology, and obviously finance can move almost at the speed of light. Mm-hmm. But how about people? In Japan, is there a lot of inward and outward migration of people?
Japan has not had much of migration for years. Japan is isolated islands, so that it's not difficult. It is difficult, for those people to sort of come to Japan, navigating on the sea. So that immigrants in this country has been relatively small compared to other, particularly compared to European nations.
So Admiral Perry is still resented in some places, huh? he tried to break down the barriers. Was that in the 1860s, as I recall? But
Japan is a very unique country because we have not had an experience of mixture of the races, for more than 1,000 years. Japanese race has been here, and we have not been mixed with other races that much. Mm. Yeah. Mm. It's very unique. Well, yeah.
I was going to say, if you watch television in the United States right now, you can understand the turmoil associated with racial, what we call otherness. And I've done research papers with a man who's actually at Premji University named Arjun Jayadev, where he's done the geography in the United States of where there is disruption and where there is economic suffering. He's then compared that with survey data on economic insecurity, and obviously they work in lockstep. But the most interesting thing is wherever there is economic insecurity is a geographic location where there is also heightened racial animosity.
Is that right?
It seems that economic distress ignites otherness and racial animosity. And so these things are not two separate things. They actually exacerbate one another.
Yeah, Japan and the U.S. is quite a contrast. U.S. does have a diverse races, various diversities, where Japan is quite homogeneous, in terms of the race, in terms of, various other sort of traits.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I would say that Scandinavia, in some ways, is similar like that as well. Have a relatively broad middle class and people of the same ethnic and religious and racial.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Traditions or backgrounds, and so some of these, what we used to call in America the melting pot, presents very, very big challenges in the modern era. And when you look at globalization, you mentioned it, it's pervasive now, but how does the nation state, like the Japanese nation, take care of its people when money has wings, can stay offshore, when the kind of disruptions that flow through your society may be beyond your control because they may emanate from other places? I know many people are very hostile towards globalization, and in part, I think it's the fault of our governance because, say, in the United States, they say everybody can be better off with globalization, but the losers are allowed to lose, and there's no transfers or no adjustment assistance in America so that those who lose really lose. And in America, we've had a few people win a lot, and a lot of people lose quite a bit. And so it's hollowed out the middle class. Peter Temin wrote a wonderful book called The Vanishing Middle Class. And How does Japan handle the pressures of globalization?
That's partly true. You know, there are those, as you say, who could sort of benefit from the globalization. But more than half of the people would lose out in this globalization, sort of globalized world. So that the state has to take care of that. But I think in Japan, it has been done fairly well. Social security system is quite sufficient so that we don't see any major losses of the globalization. You know, somehow there are some safety nets which would sort of support them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in essence, those transfers and those adjustment assistance are part of the Japanese spirit of governance.
Yeah, I think
so. Much more so than in, say, the United States or Great
Britain. That's right. That's right. Yeah. You know, Japan does sort of value the egalitarianism so that, you know, our social security system is built in such a way so that people are quite sort of equal vis-a-vis with each other. So that we do not have so many extremely rich people. We don't have so many extremely poor people. You know, 95% would be the middle class in this country.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine, I don't know this, but I'm asking, that the number of people who are in prison as a percentage of the population must be very low in Japan compared to some of the Western countries.
Yeah, I think Japanese crime rate is among the lowest in OECD countries.
Mm-hmm. I remember the first time that I went to Japan in about 1985 when I worked on Capitol Hill. Mm-hmm. And I said, I was staying at the Hotel Okura. Mm-hmm. And I said to a man, well, is it safe to go out to Roppongi late at night? Because there were some good music stores I wanted to go see. Uh-huh. Old, you know, jazz music that I might be able to buy. Uh-huh. And he said, I'll tell you how dangerous it is. He said, you can put your wallet on your head and walk down the street. And if it falls off your head, somebody will pick it up and hand it back to you.
Yeah, that happens, you know. If when you lose something in Japan, you'd always get it back.
Yeah. Well, that was quite a contrast for a boy that grew up in Detroit, where things were a little more rough and tumble, and as is often the case in many parts of America. So do you at this point, various traditions and successes in the way Japan has treated its people. Mm-hmm. I would think, you know, we have this kind of ethic in the United States that what we try to do is emulate success. You know, what they say, the better mousetrap wins. Mm-hmm. Everybody tries to keep up with the best. Well, it sounds as if, from your perspective, that in Japan, many of these social challenges are much better handled than they are in the West. When is the world going to start to imitate that more successful model?
Well, you know, ordinary capitalistic country leave, you know, things to be determined by the markets. You know, some people win, some people lose, and that's the way it is, you know, most of the people think. But the Japanese way of thinking is that, social security system should be built in such a way that the losers is sort of rescued by the state. And, you know, there are not many losers in this country. You know, as I said, most of the Japanese people are middle class, maybe more than 90%. And, you know, state healthcare system and various social security system does help. And it's very important. And mm-hmm. to some extent, as you said, Japan is like a Scandinavian country where, you know, state provides security to its residents.
Yes. It's interesting that you brought up the Scandinavian countries because so a gentleman used to be a minister years ago. I was a financial speculator when the Swedish kroner had trouble working with Soros back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And a man named Leif Pogrotsky, mm-hmm. who is a delightful individual, became a good friend, and he eventually ran the U.S. consulate for Sweden in the United States. And he brought some Swedish people, experts, scholars, to New York and invited me to a dinner. And at the dinner, the Swedish scholars were challenging us. And what they said was, in the old days, people would say the American model of supply-side flexibility and reallocation of resources was considered the growth model, and the European model was considered to be sclerosis, meaning all gummed up and bogged up and didn't make the adjustment and stagnant.
I see.
But then he said, what's happening now, and President Trump had been in office for about a year at that time, he said, what's happening now is that in America, people are starting to fight against technical change and globalization and all kinds of things because they know the losers lose. And he, this man said, there is an article coming out in the New York Times by Peter Goodman next week for which I was interviewed, and it's called We Love the Robots. And what he basically said was, technical innovation creates new production possibility frontier. And he said, we don't protect jobs. We protect people. So that you may have to get retrained, but you'll have health care. You'll have a pension. Your children will be educated. All of these things that guard or protect the quality of life and humanity will be there. But we won't protect your job. You may have to learn, you may have to transform and evolve with the, so that we can take advantage of the possibilities. But and so the conclusion they gave to me was, in Sweden, they love the robots and they are therefore going to keep growing and take advantage of the technology. And in America, the social conflict may destroy our ability to
see
the best in technology and evolve and continue so that the growth model of what is a success and a failure in this era of rampant change from globalization and technology may make the American model, what you might call it, less effective and less functional. I thought it was an interesting perspective.
I agree. You know, American type free market capitalism does create, you know, so losers. And, you know, many American sort of administrators think it's inevitable. But I think, you know, Swedish model or Scandinavian model, you know, tries to sort of, decrease the number of the losers and, you know, create, you know, middle class society, you know, as a result.
And that how would I say, that feeling of protection may be what gives the society the courage to continue to embrace technological change and to evolve.
I think so, yeah.
And the resistance, as the Swedes suggested to me, in the United States may impair our ability to continue to thrive. How does China fit into that scheme? Do they take care of the losers, as Japan does, or are they closer to the American side of the pendulum?
Yeah, well, although China claims to be a socialist country, I think Chinese system is very close to the U.S. system. They do not take care of the losers.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I once did a survey for INET with a global data intensive firm, and we interviewed five places, the UK, the United States, China, India, and continental Europe, about what young people wanted to learn about in economics. And what they came back was, in continental Europe and India, people wanted to learn about what is the right social design for a good society. And in the United States, China, and the UK, what the young people wanted to learn about was how to make money.
Yeah, China in that sense is very close to the US.
Yeah, that was the surprising result of the study, which this company called Purpose, Australian-based company, worked with us to understand as we were trying to, how would I say, increase the attractiveness of our Young Scholars Initiative, which has now got approximately 12,000 people participating from various places around the world. But it was a fascinating, like you said, the closeness between the U.S. and China, which is a little bit counterintuitive, but there it was. And that was fascinating. So what do you think the U.S. and China could do to make Japan better off in this next 10 years? How would you ask the U.S. and China to...
Well, you know, China, U.S.-China sort of conflicts does not help Japan at all. And Japan could be a good mediator. You know, we are both close to the U.S. and China in various fields. So that I think, you know, U.S. could take advantage of Japan, you know, to be an mediator between the you know, U.S. and China. And U.S.-China sort of tension does not help either, you know, China or U.S. and Japan.
Yes, yes. Well, you're on the cusp as a country of a change in the prime minister. I understand for health-related reasons, Prime Minister Abe will be leaving office shortly. And maybe we should explore what kind of new prime ministers have the skills to be the mediator of this big global conflict between U.S. and China.
Well, the next prime minister is probably Mr. Suga, who is the Secretary General of the Cabinet Secretary General. And he would probably follow Abe's policy, so that there won't be any major change of Japanese policies, external policies in particular.
Okay, so there's what you might call a deep common practice. As the leadership changes, there'll be a great deal of continuity.
That's right, that's right. And Mr. Abe has sort of provided the stability to the Japanese politics and administration. He is the longest serving prime minister since the Meiji Restoration. So that the next prime minister, I hope, would follow Mr. Abe to sort of keep providing the stability to the Japanese politics and Japanese economy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. That's fascinating. So I guess my last question comes back to your being a scuba diver. what do we have to do as citizens about our oceans and our seas? What kind of policies does someone who cares for the water, for the oceans, for the undersea life, and for the coastlines, what kind of things do you pray will well, be embraced by mankind?
Well, I don't see any specific policies to be implemented immediately, but, you know, ocean is the great asset for the human beings, so that we could sort of, we should take policies to protect the soundness of the sea, which is very important. That would be the key to the survival of the human beings.
Yes, that's what I read, but my understanding is it's very hard to implement and enforce because there are so many what you might call common areas, and places like the United Nations can see what to be done, but they don't have the enforcement power to make sure that it is done.
That's right. And, countries like U.S. and Europe and Japan should take a leadership in trying to sort of, maintain clean and good ocean.
Yes, yes. Well, I've experienced the joy of being under the ocean many times. I've probably done 400 or 500 dives in my life.
Is that right? I have done quite a lot as well, you know.
Yeah, I knew that. I knew that. And I wanted to share with you, there was a famous rock and roll act in America called the Grateful Dead. Uh-huh. And the leader was a man named Jerry Garcia. Uh-huh. And he was known to be, this was 60s and early 70s, uh-huh. one who experimented with psychedelic drugs. Uh-huh. And somebody once asked him in a press conference, is there anything better than LSD? He said, only one thing, scuba diving.
Comparison with LSD is something.
But just how, you know, in that, mm-hmm. that place, it's almost like without gravity, with balance and all the beautiful motion and colors and everything else, Garcia was inspired to put the experience of scuba diving at the top.
Yeah, last summer I went to Okinawa, the southern island in Japan. It was very beautiful. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for joining me tonight.
Okay.
You've taken us on a tour under the sea and around the world from the eyes of Japan, and I'm sure that the various people in the audience here will be very grateful, as I am, for your insights. And I know as we work together on the Global Commission over the course of the next year and work on many things related to economics and education and transformation, I'm quite sure I will call you to come back for another episode and help us to see things from that vantage point.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Yep.
It's been a lovely night, and I look forward to our next episode in the not-too-distant future, perhaps just after the presidential election.
Okay. I look forward to that.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Yep.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.